A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. The U.S., Israel, and Lebanon signed a trilateral framework agreement yesterday. The State Department put it out with the usual fanfare about lasting peace and sovereign neighborly relations. But the timing is what grabs you. Iranian drone swarm toward Haifa 48 hours ago. Israeli ground forces still operating in southern Lebanon. And this document lands right in the middle of it. Daniel wants us to walk through the actual text and figure out what's really happening here.
What jumps out immediately is what the agreement is not. It is not a ceasefire. There is no halt to hostilities clause anywhere in those 14 pages. It's a framework for a process. A sequenced, conditional process that structures how Israeli forces might eventually redeploy out of Lebanese territory, contingent on the Lebanese armed forces demonstrating effective control and disarming what the text calls non-state armed groups.
Which is the document's most conspicuous silence? Hezbollah is never named. 14 pages of diplomatic architecture, and the primary armed actor in southern Lebanon is referred to entirely through euphemism.
That's not an oversight. It's the hinge the whole thing turns on. The Lebanese government cannot sign a document that explicitly names Hezbollah as the problem. That would be politically impossible for the caretaker government. So you get non-state armed elements, non-state armed groups, associated infrastructure. The constructive ambiguity lets Lebanon sign without formally acknowledging that Hezbollah controls the south. But it also means the agreement has no legal mechanism to target Hezbollah directly. It's a monitoring framework aimed at a ghost.
A ghost with an estimated 150,000 rockets, by the way. But we'll get to that. What I find striking is the document's relationship to the actual battlefield. You have Article 7 laying out a three-phase Israeli withdrawal over 60 days, each phase contingent on the Lebanese army demonstrating what the text calls effective control. That's a subjective standard. It effectively gives Israel a veto over its own withdrawal timeline.
And this is where the comparison to UNSCR 7001 from 2006 becomes unavoidable. That resolution also required Hezbollah disarmament south of the Litani. It was never enforced. The new agreement essentially replicates the same structural flaw. It demands an outcome that the Lebanese state lacks the capacity to deliver. But it adds a U.S.-led verification committee with real-time intelligence sharing. Satellite imagery, SIGINT commitments from Washington. That's new. That's significant.
The U.S. moves from being a mediator to being a direct party to Israeli security operations. The intelligence sharing appendix, effectively, makes the Lebanese armed forces a proxy intelligence collector for Israel, which is a remarkable thing to put in writing.
It mirrors the data-sharing framework from the 2024 U.S.-Ukraine Security Agreement, but without the same oversight safeguards. No congressional notification requirements, no defined limits on what intelligence gets shared or how it's used. The U.S. is now the guarantor of a border it cannot fully monitor, with no clear exit if the agreement collapses.
Which brings us to the 1983 precedent, May 17th, 1983, the last time the U.S. guaranteed an Israel-Lebanon agreement. It collapsed within 9 months when Syria refused to withdraw. The Marines left Beirut in February 1984 after the barracks bombing, so there's a historical echo here that's hard to ignore.
The regional context makes it even more precarious. The agreement explicitly excludes any mention of Iran. It's a document about the Lebanon front that pretends the Iran front doesn't exist. But satellite imagery from June 25th confirms the Quds force has already moved Fateh 1110 guidance kits to forward depots in the Bekwaye Valley. Iran is racing to arm Hezbollah before the monitoring mechanism becomes operational.
You have this bizarre diplomatic vacuum at the center of the agreement. It structures a process for the northern border while the eastern front, the actual Iran-Israel war, remains fully active. The drone swarm toward Haifa on June 25th didn't come from Lebanon. It came from Iran. and the agreement has nothing to say about it.
Which is by design. The agreement effectively decouples the Lebanon front from the Iran front. That's the strategic logic. If the monitoring mechanism holds, Israel can shift forces east while maintaining plausible deniability on the northern border. Netanyahu gets a diplomatic win to counter domestic pressure over the stalled hostage negotiations. Lebanon's caretaker government uses the agreement to secure IMF tranche releases tied to border stability. Both sides have incentives to sign, but not necessarily to implement.
The implementation question is where the whole thing gets wobbly. The Lebanese armed forces have approximately 15,000 troops in southern Lebanon. They need an estimated 30,000 for effective control. The agreement demands capacity that simply doesn't exist. Hezbollah is already framing the agreement as a surrender document, which puts the LAF between Israeli-demanded security measures and domestic legitimacy.
The text tries to paper over this with the pilot zones mechanism. Two initial zones have been agreed to by the IDF and the LAF. The LAF gradually assumes security responsibility in these zones, and upon confirmed successful disarmament, reconstruction begins and civilians return. It's a test and verify model. But here's the thing. The agreement never defines what constitutes a material breach that would trigger Israeli reentry. It creates obligations without defining consequences.
The enforcement mechanism is a monitoring body, not an enforcement body. The U.S.-led committee can authorize Israeli overflights for surveillance, but cannot compel Lebanon to disarm Hezbollah. It can only report violations. If reports go dark, the agreement is already dead. Silence is the tell.
That's the key metric to track over the next 60 days. Not whether the agreement holds in some abstract sense, but whether the U.S.-led committee actually publishes violation reports. The 45-day mark is particularly important. That's when the first withdrawal phase is due, and when Hezbollah will almost certainly test the mechanism with a limited rocket attack to probe whether the committee actually functions.
To Daniel's question, what are we looking at here? It's a rules of engagement manual dressed in peace deal clothing. A 14-page document that never names the primary armed actor it's supposed to constrain, signed while that actor's patron is actively launching drones at Israeli cities. The text is sophisticated, diplomatic engineering. The question is whether it can survive contact with the reality it's been carefully written to avoid acknowledging.
The thing I keep coming back to is the document's preamble language. It talks about irreversible progress toward the comprehensive resolution of all issues, and ending decades of conflict. But you read the actual operative sections, and there's no irreversibility mechanism, no automatic consequences. Every step is conditional on someone else acting first.
Which is how you get a framework agreement that reads like a peace treaty in the front half, and a military coordination protocol in the back half. The preamble invokes the UN Charter and the right of each state to exist in peace. Then Article something or other gives the US-led committee authority over Israeli surveillance overflights. It's a strange hybrid.
The obligations are asymmetrical in ways that matter. Lebanon commits to a rigorous performance-based program to build LAF capacity and disarm non-state groups, with US assistance strictly conditioned on verifiable milestones. Israel commits to redeployment that is itself contingent on Lebanon meeting those milestones. So Lebanon's obligation is absolute. Israel's is conditional. That's not a criticism. It reflects the reality that Israel holds the military cards. But it means the document's architecture is fundamentally a Lebanese performance contract, not a mutual security treaty.
If the document named Hezbollah, the Lebanese government would have to either admit it can't control Hezbollah, making the agreement impossible to sign, or claim it can, which Hezbollah would immediately disprove. The ambiguity is what makes the signature possible, but it's also what makes implementation impossible, because the entity that actually needs to disarm was never a party to the negotiation.
That gets to the heart of Daniel's question about whether this is a breakthrough or a tactical pause. The text creates a 60-day window. During that window, Israel can claim diplomatic progress while continuing operations against Iran on the Eastern Front. Lebanon's caretaker government can point to the agreement as evidence of restored sovereignty while pursuing IMF funds. Hezbollah gets time to rearm via the Bekwa'i Valley supply route, which the agreement doesn't address. Everyone gets something from the process. Nobody is actually required to change their behavior.
The agreement's real function isn't to end the conflict. It's to create a structured period in which all parties can pursue their actual objectives under the cover of a diplomatic framework. The question isn't whether the agreement will be implemented as written. It's what each party does with the 60 days.
Let me walk through Article 4 specifically, because this is where the enforcement architecture either works or doesn't. The U.S.-led committee can authorize Israeli overflights for surveillance purposes. That's in the text. But when it comes to actual disarmament, the committee's authority stops at reporting. It can document that Hezbollah hasn't disarmed. It cannot compel Lebanon to do anything about it.
It's a monitoring body with a camera, not a sheriff with a badge.
And the camera only works if someone's willing to look at the footage. The text says the committee verifies and supports the process. Those are soft verbs. There's no mechanism for what happens when verification confirms non-compliance. The assumption seems to be that naming and shaming will create sufficient pressure. But Hezbollah has been named and shamed by UNIFIL for 18 years, and it hasn't mattered.
Which loops back to the constructive ambiguity on Hezbollah. The committee is monitoring the disarmament of an entity the agreement refuses to name. How do you verify the disarmament of something you can't legally identify?
You don't. You verify that the Lebanese armed forces have deployed to certain zones. You verify that visible infrastructure has been dismantled. But the rocket stockpiles, the tunnel networks, the command and control, none of that gets touched unless the LAF actively goes after it, which requires political will and military capacity it doesn't have.
That's where Article 7's withdrawal conditions become the real leverage point. Three phases over 60 days, each contingent on the LAF demonstrating effective control. But effective control is never defined. It's a subjective standard, which means Israel decides whether it's been met.
Which is functionally a veto. Israel can say, we don't assess effective control has been achieved, and the withdrawal clock stops. Compare this to UNSCR 71. That resolution also called for Hezbollah disarmament south of the Litani, but it didn't give Israel a conditional withdrawal mechanism. It just called for things and hoped. The new agreement tries to solve that by making Israeli redeployment contingent on Lebanese performance. But it creates a paradox. The party that most wants withdrawal controls whether withdrawal happens, based on a standard only it can interpret.
The intelligence sharing appendix adds another layer to this asymmetry. The U.S. provides Lebanon with satellite imagery and SIGINT of Hezbollah positions. On paper, this helps the LAF do its job. In practice, it means the LAF becomes a conduit for Israeli targeted intelligence under the cover of a trilateral framework.
The 2024 U.S.-Ukraine security agreement had a similar data sharing structure, but it included congressional oversight provisions and defined limits on intelligence use. This agreement has none of that, no sunset clauses on data retention, no restrictions on how shared intelligence can be employed operationally. The U.S. is essentially writing blank check surveillance into a diplomatic document.
Then there's what the document doesn't address at all. No mention of Iran. We covered that. But also no mechanism to stop weapons smuggling from Syria. The Bekaa Valley supply route remains completely unaddressed. No definition of what constitutes a material breach that would trigger Israeli re-entry. The agreement creates a whole architecture of obligations without specifying what happens when those obligations aren't met.
Which is the document's fundamental design choice. It's built for a best-case scenario. The LAF gradually asserts control. Hezbollah quietly complies. Reconstruction begins. But it has no circuit breaker for the scenario that's actually unfolding. Iran racing weapons to Hezbollah while the ink dries, and the LAF caught between an Israeli demand for action and a domestic political reality that makes action impossible.
The loopholes aren't bugs. They're features negotiated in by parties who needed to sign something without actually committing to anything irreversible. Lebanon gets to say it never formally acknowledged Hezbollah controls the south. Israel gets a veto over its own withdrawal. The U.S. gets to be the guarantor of a process it can enforce. Everyone gets what they need from the text. Nobody gets what they need from the reality.
The Iranian dimension is where the knock-on effect get genuinely alarming. Tehran denounced the agreement within hours, called it a license for Israeli aggression, which is predictable rhetoric. But the satellite imagery from June 25th tells the real story. Quds Force units moving FATE 1110 guidance kits to forward depots in the Becca AADAAA Valley. These are the precision guidance upgrades that turn unguided rockets into something that can hit specific targets. Iran isn't waiting to see how the monitoring mechanism plays out. It's racing the clock.
The 60-day window the agreement creates is also the window Iran is using to rearm Hezbollah before any verification infrastructure gets stood up. The agreement structures a process for the northern border, while Iran treats that same period as a logistics sprint.
The Bekua Valley supply route is completely unaddressed in the text, no mechanism to interdict it. The agreement is focused on what happens south of the Latani, while the weapons pipeline runs through the Bekaya, which is north of the Latani and entirely outside the framework's geographic scope.
Which means the demilitarized zone is being armed from the wrong side of its own boundary. The 10-kilometer zone south of the Latani is supposed to be cleared of non-state armed elements, but the resupply is happening north of it, and the agreement has nothing to say about that.
The Lebanese government's position here is impossible. The LAF has roughly 15,000 troops in the south. Independent assessments put the number needed for effective control at around 30,000. So you're asking a force at half the necessary strength to disarm an organization that is better armed than it is, while that organization is being actively resupplied by a regional power, and while that same organization is telling the Lebanese public that the agreement is a surrender document.
Hezbollah's framing matters because it puts the LAF in an impossible political position. If the army moves to implement the disarmament provisions, it's acting against what Hezbollah has already defined as Lebanese national interest. If it doesn't, Israel withholds withdrawal. Either way, the LAF loses.
We haven't even gotten to the U.S. exposure question. The United States is now the formal guarantor of this process. The intelligence-sharing commitments make Washington a direct party to the verification mechanism, but there's no exit clause. No definition of what happens if the agreement collapses. No mechanism for the U.S. to withdraw its guarantees without being seen as abandoning the framework it brokered.
The 1983 parallel is uncomfortable for exactly this reason. The May 17th agreement, U.S. guaranteed, Israel-Lebanon collapsed in 9 months when Syria refused to withdraw. The Marine deployment that was supposed to stabilize things ended with the Barracks bombing in October 1983, and the last Marines left in February 1984. The U.S. was left holding the bag on a guarantee it couldn't enforce.
The difference this time is that the U.S. isn't putting boots on the ground. It's putting satellites in the sky and analysts at monitoring stations. But the strategic exposure is similar. You're guaranteeing an outcome you don't control, in a theater where multiple actors have incentives to undermine you, with no clear off-ramp.
Which brings us to what this means for the broader Iran-Israel war. The agreement's real strategic function is decoupling. If the northern border can be stabilized, even on paper, Israel can shift attention and assets to the eastern front against Iran proper. The drone swarm toward Haifa on June 25th wasn't a Lebanese event, it was an Iranian event. And the agreement creates a framework where Israel can say the Lebanon front is being managed diplomatically while it focuses on the actual shooting war with Tehran.
That only works if the monitoring mechanism holds. If Hezbollah tests it with a rocket attack at the 45-day mark, which is the consensus expectation among analysts I've spoken with, then the decoupling collapses. Israel has to respond on the northern border, and suddenly you're fighting on two fronts again while pretending one of them is governed by a diplomatic framework.
The domestic political calculus on both sides reinforces this tension. Netanyahu needs something he can call a diplomatic achievement. The hostage negotiations are stalled, domestic pressure is mounting, and a signed agreement with Lebanon, even one that doesn't end the conflict, provides a narrative. Lebanon's caretaker government, meanwhile, is using the agreement to unlock IMF tranche releases that are explicitly tied to border stability benchmarks.
Both leaderships have incentives to keep the agreement alive on paper, even if implementation stalls. Netanyahu can point to the framework as evidence of progress. Lebanon's government can point to it as evidence of restored sovereignty and fiscal responsibility. The agreement becomes useful as a political instrument regardless of whether it actually changes anything on the ground.
Which is a different kind of risk. if the agreement's value to both parties is the appearance of a process rather than the substance of one, then the verification committee's reports become the only honest signal in the system. And as we said earlier, if those reports go dark, the agreement is already dead. If you're an analyst or an investor trying to figure out where this thing actually goes, the 45-day mark is your tripwire. That's when the first withdrawal phase comes due. That's also when Hezbollah will almost certainly test the monitoring mechanism, probably with a limited rocket attack, something calibrated to probe whether the US-led committee actually publishes violation reports.
The test isn't really about the rockets. It's about the committee's response. Does it name the violation publicly? Does it attribute it? Or does the report use the same constructive ambiguity the agreement itself uses? Unidentified non-state armed elements conducted an action, which tells you nothing and signals to Hezbollah that the mechanism has no teeth.
Silence is the tell. If the committee goes quiet after a provocation, the agreement's enforcement function is already dead. Everyone's just going through the motions.
For policy professionals, the fatal flaw is simpler than any of the textual loopholes we've been discussing. The agreement relies on Lebanese state capacity that doesn't exist. 15,000 LAF troops in the south, 30,000 needed for effective control. That's not a gap you close with diplomatic language. Without a troop surge, which requires funding, recruitment, training, and political will that nobody is offering. The demilitarized zone is a paper construct.
The single cleanest metric for whether this framework has any chance isn't the violation reports, isn't the withdrawal timeline, it's LAF troop numbers in the south. If that number doesn't start climbing within the first 30 days, the whole architecture is built on a foundation that isn't there.
That brings us to the question that's going to define the next 60 days. What happens when the withdrawal window closes and Hezbollah hasn't disarmed? Because that's not a hypothetical, it's the base case. Do Israeli forces re-enter southern Lebanon? Does the agreement become another UNSCR 71? A dead letter that everyone pretends is still alive because acknowledging its death would be worse than the fiction?
That's the structural tension the whole thing is built on. The agreement creates a process that demands an outcome nobody can deliver, on a timeline that ends with a choice nobody wants to make. Israel either re-enters, which blows up the diplomatic framework it just signed, or it doesn't, which tells Hezbollah the conditional withdrawal was never really conditional.
If the agreement becomes 7-1 version 2, it doesn't just fail quietly. It fails while the U.S. is formally on the hook as guarantor, with intelligence-sharing commitments that make Washington complicit in whatever happens next. That's a worse position than 2006, when the U.S. could at least maintain some distance from UNIFIL's inability to enforce the resolution.
The open question isn't whether the agreement will be implemented as written. It's whether the 60-day clock produces something real, a verifiable shift in the security architecture, or whether it just produces 60 days of diplomatic cover for all parties to keep doing what they were already doing.
We'll be tracking the first week of the monitoring mechanism next episode, assuming the committee's initial reports are released. Those first reports will tell us more than the agreement text ever could.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The pigment known as Harrison's Red, developed in the 1840s, was derived from a synthetic mercury-sulfur compound and became the standard red dye for British military uniforms manufactured in wool mills across the Outer Hebrides.
The Outer Hebrides had a military dye industry. I did not know that. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions, geopolitical, technical, or otherwise, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. For Herman Poppleberry, I'm Korn. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ears.
stay curious, keep weird in mind.